Squelching, just like screaming. My parents always thought I was just like screaming in the basement, but I was like singing. If I was feeling a lot that day, I would just go into the basement, I would sing.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Another episode of Story and Craft. How are you? Had a good week? Things been going okay? Hope everything's going great with you. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for stopping by, checking it out. Going to have a great episode this week. Really enjoyed this chat. I mean, I've had the good fortune of sitting down with some really interesting, intriguing people. But this week, loved this chat. Melissa O'Neill, she plays Officer Lucy Chen on the ABC television show The Rookie. Great personality, a lot of energy, very insightful. Just, I really enjoyed this sit down. She was beyond a pleasure to chat with. We talked about being from Canada. She even won Canadian Idol at 17 years old. She's been on Broadway, and just really enjoyed the conversation, and I think you will as well. Don't forget, if you would, pop on by storyandcraftpod.com. Once again, storyandcraftpod.com, the website. Everything you could possibly want to know about the show is right there. And if you would, as always, subscribe, like the show on your favorite podcast app, leave a review, drop a star, whatever you do on your app. All right, so let's get after it. This week is Melissa O'Neill Week, right here on Story and Craft. How's your day been going so far?
It's been a little crazy. You know, I think everyone else is in their own type of experience with COVID, but on our show, which I think is one of the only shows that hasn't been shut down by COVID, we have like pretty extreme protocols. And even if somebody is asymptomatic, but if they've tested positive, and even if they're beyond the CDC guidelines of like, if you're 10 days, even if you're still testing positive, as long as you're not symptomatic, you're fine to reintegrate. That is not the case on our show. And so it creates a lot of, it means that we're reshooting a lot of things. So I will shoot things twice.
I'm gathering you're restraining a little bit of frustration right now.
I don't think I'm restraining it at all. This is an accurate representation of my general, let's see. It gets a little mundane after a while. You're like, really? This again?
Oh, I think that's very common. Yeah, everybody I'm speaking with, yeah. I was talking with an actor named Shea Whigham the other day, and he says, hang on, I got to go do something. He had to run to his front door because somebody came to his house to swab his nose. And I'm like, mm-hmm. It's things you don't even think of.
Yeah.
Well, we can blame it all on Nathan Fillion because he's technically the boss, right? So we'll just lay it all on his shoulders.
No. No, that's silly. How are you?
Doing very well, actually. Now, your folks said you had a chat with your producer, so it gave me a chance to go and I'd go and pop into my studio and record some stuff.
Oh.
So actually, it was very efficient. I got something out of the way I needed to get done.
Do you work from home?
I do.
Oh, cool.
I took a break from acting because my teenagers were kind of aging to the point where it's like my second kid's now going off to college.
Whoa.
And COVID and all that is like, you know, I'm just going to chill out at home. And I admit,
wait, does this mean you don't have anyone at home anymore? Is that the last one?
I got a 16-year-old daughter who's starting her junior year. So she's the last one. This is like a slow emptying of the nest. So I'm,
how does that feel?
That's a really good question. Let's see here. Mm-hmm. Let me lay down on the sofa here and go a little bit of therapy. No, actually, I'm so proud of them because of who they are and where they're going. But it's like I have like on my monitors right here in my studio, I've got a picture of my kids back when they were like, you know, 9, 8, and 6, I think. And I'm sitting there going, that was 2 seconds ago, I think. So it's kind of wild. They're getting off to school. Proud of them. I'm finding I'm trying to evolve ways of busying myself because I think once they're all off to school, then I think that's going to be an interesting experience. But I'm actually, my youngest wants to go to school. She was looking at UCLA, now it's Texas or some So I'm going to be moving.
Oh, out of state.
Oh, yeah. She wants to get the heck out of Dodge. Now, I'm originally from Dallas, lived in Southern California, but now in New Orleans. So this is where my ex-wife lives here. So it's kind of like if you marry somebody from New Orleans, whether you're still married to them or not, you always end up staying in New Orleans for a period of time, which this was kind of Hollywood South for half a second. It was really busy before a lot of stuff went to Atlanta.
That's right.
But everybody from LA is moving to Texas, it seems like. So, you know, maybe I should...
Texas or Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a native Texan, so maybe I'm just kind of like, all the crazy politics there aside, it's a good place to set up shop. But you're originally from Canada, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Now, where in Canada are you from?
I was born and raised in Calgary. I spent most of my time in Toronto, though, from the time I was 16.
So you think casting with Nathan Fillion had anything to do with the fact that you're from Canada? You think that gave you a leg up since he's from there as well? Or do you think that was... not even a factor.
Well, probably not, but it doesn't hurt to have something to share with someone in the room.
Yeah, he's, you know, every time I hear him, whenever he's in an interview, he's such an affable guy. You know, he seems like he's...
Have you met him?
I have not. I've wanted to. My two oldest, my 19 and 8, well, next in a few weeks, 18-year-old, love The Rookie. You know, that's their thing. We all, that's kind of one of those few things we can still kind of sit down and watch together. They love watching The Rookie, and I believe you're one of their favorite characters. So they're, I'm sure, going to be very jealous that they weren't here today. So, but y'all are going into season, is it four? Is that what's about to start?
We're filming season 5 right now.
You're filming 5 right now. Okay. Now, going back to real quick, kind of hit and rewind to the origin story, because I was very pleasantly surprised that the whole Canadian Idol thing, did that launch, do you know, roughly the same time as American Idol did, or did it kind of come a few years later? Was it kind of in parallel with what was going on down here?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that a few years of American Idol happened before Canadian Idol launched.
I know in one of the episodes, they alluded to the whole American Idol thing. Was that something that they were just trying to work something in where, okay, we got to get her to sing somehow on an episode?
I think that they were trying to include that. I'm not sure if they were aware of it, but, you know, we were airing around the same time. I think Idol was our lead-in. And so it was like a fun way to do a crossover, and they decided to put that piece in.
That was very cool. At that time, I didn't know that you had won Canadian Idol. I mean, you're very young. You were like 17, 18 when you won. What was that like going back? I mean, many moons ago when I was roughly 17, I started working on the radio in Dallas. And I thought that was kind of a heady thing. I thought I was all famous and stuff for like 2 seconds. But at that age, what's it like to actually have that much attention put on you and you win and now there is an expectation of performing? What was that like back then, being that age?
It was really uncomfortable. Yeah, I don't think that, you know, if I could, I mean, maybe it's different now because a lot of young people with technology and Instagram and social media, there's a lot of... kids that are kind of trained from the time they're very young to be in front of cameras and to center themselves. But at the time, it was really uncomfortable. And I think a big part of that experience is what kind of led me to being interested in ensemble work and working in groups. I'm not terribly thrilled about being a solo act or a centerpiece. It's a lot of pressure, and I don't really have any aspirations for... fame.
Yeah, that's funny. The thing you said about teenagers, my 16-year-old, oddly, she hates when I take pictures of her. She can't stand her picture. When her friends take pictures and want to post it on Instagram, she wants to have nothing to do with that, which is kind of makes me happy a little bit because the polar opposite is just, you're right. That's a really wonderful way of putting it. A lot of the kids now are trained to showcase themselves.
It's just a part of the zeitgeist, you know? It's like the thing to do these days.
Yeah, everybody's creating content, you know? And some of them's like, I kind of like a little anonymity sometimes, or, you know, but the question, what immediately thereafter, after you won, and you said you were working on ensemble stuff, you were working on stage, and what were you doing predominantly on stage? And the second half of that question is, how did that end up leading to you being on camera?
I think I was on tour at the time when I got a call to audition for a stage production that ended up running for quite a while. We did the North American premiere of Dirty Dancing, and I think they were having a hard time finding like a pop singer. And so that's how I landed onto that show, and I really loved working in an ensemble group. It was exciting to be doing something creative with my voice, not needing to be the centerpiece, especially as like a young person who wasn't terribly comfortable in their body, and to also have the opportunity to really work with people who had a pedigree, because I left, I didn't go to post-secondary. I was out of high school at a very young age and then working, and it was really educational and inspiring to be around people who had gone to post-secondary for acting, for dancing, for singing. They were so knowledgeable, and I learned a lot during the 8, 10 years. Wow.
Wow, that is kind of a big maturing phase.
Yeah, it really
I
was.
can't imagine being that age, being on your own touring. Is it like American Idol, where after the show, I guess top 10 or so, the finalists, if you will, all go on tour together? Is that kind of how it works?
No, it was just the runner-up and I. We toured, I think we did like 36 cities. But I mean, do you remember the summer, the 2 months of your summer when you were 17?
Yes.
Like it's a really like brief. Oh, well, that sounds like it must have been a really good summer then. I'd be very curious to hear about that.
Well, I can
Forget
neither
Idol.
confirm nor
Let's hear about
deny.
the radio station.
No, it was funny because my focus was on work. Where I was talking with my daughter, the one who wants to go off to college somewhere else, and I said, one of the regrets I had in school was that I didn't focus as much on the fun and the social. I was focused on where I wanted to go, and that's, so weekends I was working on the radio, and I was just so focused on work, I forgot to stop and be 17 or 18, I'm making up for it now, I guess. But yeah, that's pretty young to be kind of out there on your own and touring. Now, are you in your family the only one who sings or does something theatrical or acts, or do you come from a family of performers?
I mean, they perform in their own way, but I wouldn't say that they do it professionally or for a living. I think for a long time, my family, my mom in particular, because she's Chinese, she was just like waiting for me to have some type of backup plan. But it's over. Like, I was, I got into it. I think I auditioned when I was still 16. I turned 17 on the show, and I just turned 34. Like,
So
I've
wait,
been
you
doing this
turned
now
17 on the show,
for,
so you're 16 when you started. Wow, okay.
yeah, when I auditioned, yeah. So it's been a long time.
Well, I was enamored. I caught a video. Your mother's from Hong Kong, correct? Which I have a great love for Hong Kong. My late grandfather used to work in women's fashions and clothes. There's just stuff he had manufactured in Hong Kong. That was back when made in China had kind of a negative connotation. But Hong Kong has always been like he would go every year and have a suit made. Every time he went to Hong Kong, I always have wanted to travel there. And the food is really what I'm kind of down with checking out. And I happen to run across a video of your mother showing you how to make spring rolls and talking about exploding spring roll. I'm curious, did you catch a lot of the, or did you absorb a lot of the cooking from your mother over the years?
My mom makes all sorts of food. One of the best dishes I remember her making is actually Jamaican jerk chicken. She's just a really exceptional cook. But no, I don't think I learned a lot. I think my mom kind of was separated from her heritage in a really big way because she left when she was a teenager.
Really?
And so, yeah, it's been a process of reclamation to reconnect with my heritage, and it's happened incidentally. We also know how to play the part. So when we were asked to take part in Heritage Month, we're like, well, let's make some spring rolls. My mom loves spring rolls though, and her spring rolls are amazing and delicious. But yeah, I mean, it would have been kind of funny if we kind of like popped on and like made jerk chicken though, wouldn't
No, that would have been awesome. That would have been like, I did not expect
it?
that. And no, my kids and I just were down on a cruise, and we went to Montego Bay, and we went to this place called Scotchies in Jamaica.
And they grill it. I mean, it's old school. They don't use like grill grates. They use sticks like wood, you know, and they grill. I'm telling you, if you're ever in Jamaica, this place, I think like Anthony Bourdain and like Andrew Zimmer and those guys, everybody pops into this place. So I had to be a tourist and do it. And I ate way too much. Now, your good father, your father, if what I'm seeing is correct, is Irish, correct? So did you get any of the bangers and mash from his side? Any kind of Irish
cooking? I love potatoes. I mean, look at me. I love potatoes. no, I mean, my dad, let's see. I think actually my dad thought we were Irish and it's kind of inherent in our surname. But I did quite a bit of digging a few years back when I think it was like 29 or something like that. And I found he was estranged. He didn't know his paternal side of the family. And I found them because I'm elder millennial, so I'm really good at interneting. And I found his entire paternal family, which is wild, because I also feel kind of disconnected from it. Even I can tell in the way I'm speaking about it. But we're not actually Irish. We're Canadian. Mm-hmm. Through and through and through. I mean, all the way back into the 1800s. I'm talking like poor, living in a tar shack with 12 other people.
Really?
Canadian. Mm-hmm. So,
did you ever do that 23andMe or Ancestry thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did both. Just because I'm nerdy like that.
No, I love that. But, each one has an advantage. I still haven't sent mine in yet. Side note. My father passed from COVID. I'm losing track, is a year and a half, 2 years ago. And then so...
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. It was, you know, a lot of people, you know, dealt with that. And it was a little surprising when I went to Dallas to have lunch with a cousin. And she said, our dinner, and we're all out eating. And she said, by the way, I got something to tell you. I did the 23andMe. And just FYI, you have a sister. Like, I grew up as an only child, and we kind of found out I got a sibling.
Like a half-sister?
Yeah. And that's, so I was like, whoa. So that was like, you know, I guess I'm no longer an only child, technically, which is, you know, this would have been good years ago when I was growing up. I always wanted to have a sibling, and I know people that have siblings, like, no, I don't want a sibling, you know.
Did you guys connect?
We did. It happened to be on that same trip. It was really neat. So we had to change. And my father had already passed, so she was asking some questions. It's a nice connection. She's got a family, and she's a couple of years younger than me, but she didn't understand how the connection happened, and I put that one together like that for her. So I kind of helped solve a little mystery for her. And my kids were very like, that's wild, because that wouldn't expect that was going to be part of my family.
So he had a secret family?
Well, no, he had a secret interlude that rendered.
Oh my God!
and the lady, and I, God bless her. She's like, listen, my father, you know, he still believes that's his child, and she didn't have the heart to break it to him. So it's a little thing, but that 23andMe. I'm going, man, the other stuff people must have found out about by going through this thing. Speaking of siblings, did you grow up with any, or are you an only kid? That you know of. I'm just kidding.
No.
I'm totally joking.
No. I have an incredible younger brother. He's 8 years my junior, and he is he's just an exceptional young man. And it's been really cool because I left home when I was young. So he was 8 when I left home. And getting to know him as an adult has been so cool. Like, I would choose him as a friend. Even if we weren't siblings. And he was out in November to visit, and it really solidified our friendship and our bond. We visited like 3 different national parks. He stayed with me for about 3 weeks, and we just had such a blast together. And on my recent hiatus, we went down to Peru together.
Really?
His name's Colin.
He's super cool. I've always wanted to go down to Peru.
Oh, you should go.
South America is so interesting. I've always wanted to travel there. But what does he do? Is he still in Canada, or did he move down here as well?
Yeah, he's in Calgary. He works in an ophthalmology clinic, and he basically runs these tests in the back that determine what type of difficulty someone is struggling with their eyesight. And it was so fun listening to him talk about his job, because I said, what do you find most interesting? Like, what lights you up about it? And he was talking about how he learned he was learning how to be like sensitive and graceful and patient, because these elderly people would come in and get tested for glaucoma, and it's like a beep test. So you see something and you got to press the button when you see it. And there's a particular cadence for the beeps. But sometimes people will come in and they're in total denial about the loss of their vision, and they'll just like press the button really rapidly because they're like, I'll catch it at some point. And then my brother has had to, and he says it happens rather frequently, and he was talking about how he really finds joy in finding creative, loving, and kind ways to explain to someone what to do without saying, hey, you're lying, and, you know, do the test properly, you know? So
he sounds like a very empathetic guy.
He is.
Has any of your other family made it down to the U.S., or are they all still in Calgary?
Everyone is still in Alberta. It would be nice to see my dad. I haven't seen him in a while. I haven't seen my mom or my dad since before the lockdown.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, you know, it's been...
Well, thank goodness for, like, Skype and stuff like that, or Zoom or whatever have you.
Yeah, it's been really nice. I mean, I certainly could have during the hiatus, but I really took our COVID compliance protocol quite seriously during work. And I couldn't bear the thought of being the person that like shut the whole thing down. And so I, you know, even during Christmas, like I just stayed in my little LA house and didn't go anywhere. And
I feel for you, because I mean, for you, Christmas time growing up has to be vastly different. You know, just you have snow, you know, and here you are. This,
yeah.
But did y'all have those like COVID marshals or those people on set that, you know, mm-hmm. were like cracking whips?
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking with somebody yesterday who said that people had vests on that either, you know, kind of policing things. Mm-hmm. But as far as what do your folks do up there? Your mom and dad?
My mom works for this corporate company. They sell like really big blinds to different like buildings. And my dad is an insurance adjuster. And he also has a really interesting lens on his profession, because he's usually the first person that people who are in crisis and dealing with like loss of their stuff, especially when like floods and stuff happen, or environmental issues.
Oh, I was there almost a year ago exactly. This is a new studio here. I'm in New Orleans in Hurricane Ida. My whole ceiling in my place came down everywhere, and it was just like nuts.
Oh my God.
And it sat there for like 2-3 weeks, and people don't realize with no AC, when you have that, it you walk in and mold is like, it's like kind of walk in and going, yep, making that call to State Farm. You know, it's like, but I was, I lived in the Jimmy Buffett Margaritaville Resort in Biloxi, Mississippi for almost a month, which was kind of cool, actually. My golden retriever loved it.
That is a long time.
But the kids liked it also. But kind of going back a little bit more, in high school, what were you up to? Was acting or singing or any kind of performance on the radar? Or were you more of a sporty kind of a kid? Or what was going on then?
I was your average overachiever Renaissance person. I was like on the rugby, basketball team. Hang on, look.
Overachiever Renaissance person. I've got to use that as my own definition.
Not just overachiever, your average overachiever, okay? Because there's lots of us. So yeah, I was like doing basketball and rugby and track.
Wait, you did rugby? They have rugby. They have like girls rugby in Canada? Really?
Yeah.
I'm very fascinated by that. So no pads or anything. Y'all are just, you know, running into each other. And
yeah, like knee pads. Yeah.
I need to go to Canada. Y'all got stuff going on up there. I'm like, I don't think they do that here. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I just heard rugby. I'm like, okay. What? But that's great. So basketball.
They do rugby. Other things down here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I was definitely into singing. I did vocal jazz and stuff, and I was always like scrunching in the basement. Like, I would get upset and I would go downstairs and I would sing along to Jackie Velasquez
What was that
really
word?
loudly.
What was that word again? You were always what in the basement?
Squelching, just like screaming.
Oh, okay.
My parents always thought I was just like screaming in the basement, but I was like singing. If I was feeling a lot that day, I would just go into the basement, I would sing. And I kind of like snuck into a couple of talent shows, and then that's kind of how auditioning for Idol came around. But that kind of unfolded into, what's happening now.
What were you listening to in high school? What were your jams?
There were three albums I had on repeat all the time. I was listening to Robin, Bumpy Ride, amazing album. I was listening to Aaliyah, AJ, Nothing But a Number. So like that really informed a lot of my music taste now. And then I was listening to Jackie Velasquez, who was this like really amazing Latin Christian singer.
Really?
And I loved her voice. And then my mom had a cassette tape of Les Mis. And so it was really, oh yeah. And then we watched Jesus Christ Superstar almost every Easter. And so when
Really?
I eventually did, yeah. And when I eventually did those two Broadway shows, it was that's kind of like the transition into screen, because I had already done Les Mis in Canada and then also on Broadway. And then I was doing JCS and, oh no, flip it the other way around. I did JCS and then I was doing Les Mis, and I was so like poor and hungry. I was living in East Harlem, and you're working on Broadway and you think you're doing good, and you're just so skinny because you're hungry and you're always going to the laundromat. And I was so over it. Like, I really just, it was the first time, people talk about the power of intention and being clear about what you want in life. And a lot of the time, I feel like the winds are kind of pushing at my back, moving me around to where I'm supposed to go. And it was the first time when I was in New York that I was just like, I'm done not having money. I don't like going to the
Isn't that
laundromat.
nice to have that clarity though, when you are go, okay, this chapter needs to close and there's something else. When you because sometimes I think that's the hardest thing to do. It's like so many choices, what do you make? And then when what Sanford Meisner says, act before you think. Your instincts are more honest than your thoughts. In life, you got to listen to your instincts, I think, as well, I think I saw it into meditation and into kind of like, I don't know how to kind of roll that up into a lifestyle, but you're a little more, the word is escaping me now. But is that a big part of your life? Is that the meditation or the kind of that kind of self-learning thing?
Yeah. I think it's like the most important thing. It's like why we're here. To do some remembering, but it requires a lot of uncovering to get to the heart of what's going on. But as it relates to acting, I mean, the more that you're able to fully live your life, and by that I mean be present for what's happening around you and also within you, the more I believe one is able to bring to a character. The more fully capable you are of embodying your life, including when you are avoiding yourself or experiencing emotions that maybe aren't as pleasant or kosher and, neatly wrapped up. The more capable you are of being present for the totality of your experience, the more honestly you can represent a person whose shoes you're stepping into. And so it's not so much a function of my profession that led me to that space. However, it is because of the abundance that I receive through my profession that I'm able to devote as much time to these practices that I feel help me be a better human being. And personally, I feel more equipped to approach my work in a way that makes me feel like I'm being honest.
Yeah, nobody wants to feel like a faker when they are, you're playing characters. Like, and in a way, when you're doing that, I teach voiceover, and one of the things I tell people, it's like a flow, it's a vibe, and it just comes out of you, and you're not trying to do anything. And I think that it's funny you say that. I think that the gig kind of makes you do a little bit of evaluation and in other ways that benefit you in your own, you know, life outside of work, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this industry, you know. Now, you said you're in New York on Broadway, which I think everybody thinks that's a pinnacle. You're on Broadway. But what was a lifestyle like living there? You know, you mentioned the laundry. But, I mean, what's a lifestyle like as far as doing the, doing the shows and how many days a week and how much personal time do you have? What's it like if you're on an active Broadway production?
Yeah, you're doing 8 shows a week. You don't have a personal life. it's kind of impossible. I mean, you can have a personal life, and it's quite the juggling act. And I really bow to people who are working on Broadway and have like a family and everything, because it's a really arduous schedule. And you have to, especially if you're singing, you have to live saintly. Because your vocal cords are, I mean, you know, they're such a tender part of the body, and you cannot abuse them if you want them to perform at, you know, near Olympian feats. And like JCS and Les Mis, not for everybody, but for a great deal of the company, like they're rock operas. You're doing a lot with your voice and you're feeling a lot. So most of the time, the schedule is really like go to work, sleep while you're there on double show days, go home, try to get in a workout, try to remember to eat. yeah, you're commuting a lot, but I love it. I love the bustle in New York. I feel a lot of resonance with the concentration of people who are on their way. And I feel like maybe not as much anymore, but I feel like there used to be this. Like New York, we get a bad rap about people being crusty, but it's not actually like that if you take the time to say hello and like make eye contact with somebody. Everyone is so cool.
Oh, I've never had an issue there.
Yeah, I don't know why people think that.
I think people are just I think people are a little bit more honest and direct. Now, I'm from the South, and you know, whenever somebody says, "Oh, dear, bless your heart." They're not technically saying something nice, you know. They're kind of like saying you are a dumbass, aren't you? Mm-hmm. No, that's kind of the thing. Which in New York, people are just—they'll say what's on their mind, and I appreciate it. Actually, I was supposed to move up there. I remember September 12th, 2001. We're supposed to move into a place called Liberty Plaza in Battery Park, and my ex-wife and I were going to move in there. And clearly, everything happened September 11th, and went up there a month later. I was like, I was so amped about moving to New York. I was going to work doing part-time at a radio station and do voiceover and hopefully act. And then I was like, yeah, this for a new married couple, this is not a, it's a little more rough of an atmosphere. But I can tell that when everything calmed down, it would just be a pretty magical place to live, especially if you're in your early 20s. Mm-hmm. I think that's an amazing time to live in New York. But making the transition to California, was that based on you going, I want to do on camera, or were you just kind of like, I want to do something different? How did you make that was it for a gig? How did you make the move to LA?
Well, coming to LA wasn't my first on camera job. I was in New York when that happened, and my dear agent, who's like 2 months younger than me, he had just taken over the film and television department. And I'd been with the agency for several years, and he was kind of like, why isn't Melissa auditioning for television? And he randomly sent me an email, to which I replied, who is this? I don't love when people do those like blind emails. It's like, it's nice to, you know, make introductions. In any case, those first two auditions he sent me, I screen tested for both of them, and one I booked. And that brought me back to Canada, where I filmed 3 years on this wicked show that I love so much called Dark Matter. We're just in sci-fi land in space, kicking ass. And then when that closed out, there was like a summer where I was doing, you know, I was guest starring on different shows. And during the run of Dark Matter, the man who, Adam, who became my manager down here, he had been reaching out and he was like, you should come to LA. I would love to represent you. And I was like, I was very clear with him. I had no interest in like moving to LA to try to make a go of it. Like that's not in my blood. If I book a job, I will move, but I'm not going to completely relocate to the States to like try to make it happen. And there was this pilot that came on his desk, and it was for The Rookie, and he was raving about it. He thought it was incredible. And it was the first time I had just lost my grandmother. And so I was in Calgary visiting my family. And it was the first time that I actually involved my entire family in the process of doing a self-tape. Like, I think my brother read with me, my mom reviewed the takes, my dad looked at the takes, and, you know, they didn't really know what they were commenting on, but they're like, it looks great, I guess. And I sent it off. And shortly thereafter, when I was in New York visiting with a friend, I got a call to head out to LA to do a chemistry test. And so I booked The Rookie, and then I lived in an Airbnb for like a little while when we shot the pilot and then that first season. And then I made the move down here properly in the second season. Yeah.
What was it like, though? Because when you came on, you know, you had a relationship, your character had a relationship with Nathan Fillion's character, but he's also technically the boss or whatever, you know, and this is your first big U.S. show. What was that? Was that a little bit heady for you? Was that, were there a lot of nerves or what was it like?
No, I mean, well, let's see. So in my audition, which I was well prepped for, I completely was blanking on the entire content of my side of the scene in this chemistry test. And I was cold and I was tired and I just lost my grandma. And in the middle of that, in the room filled with execs like ABC, all of the EPs, the showrunner, I was like, I gotta do some squats. And I could tell everyone was like, and I popped some squats. I got some blood flowing and then I killed it in the next version of the scene that we did. This is what I'm talking about with regards to what we were discussing a little while ago, as far as like being able to be with your experience, honor the truth of it and keep going. And I can't say that. Like, listen, I think Nathan is a very handsome and charming man. Does his capacity as an executive producer or as my boss make me nervous? No. And it wouldn't, no matter who it was, because at the end of the day, these are human beings the same way I'm a human being with my human experience. And if there's like any takeaway for me that I would share in this space for anyone who's listening, is that anytime you get to a certain level, it's like everybody in the room wants you to win. They don't have you in there to like waste your time, waste their time. They want you to win. And so the important thing is to claim that space, do whatever you need to do to feel that you are at your best, including popping some squats, if that's what you need to do in a room filled with strangers, and get there, like just get there. So no, and you know, it certainly doesn't hurt that they're all exceptionally kind human beings, you know. I didn't ever feel strange. And I believe that that's equal parts the frequency that you come into a space with, as well as how you're being received. But to allow a bunch of strangers, regardless of their status, to kind of impact your central channel, I think is giving up power that you needn't do, you know, especially in an industry that needs to be self-propelled.
I mean, that's maturity that has to have come through just doing it. Like you said, going back to when you're on Broadway and even Canadian Idol and all that. I mean, that was obviously, by then you're looking at this as a job, mm-hmm. but it's a big deal, a big network series, especially when going into season 5. That's you know, that's the dream right there, especially when you have like, well, how many episodes do y'all shoot a season, roughly?
Well, I think it was like 18 and then 20 and then COVID was like 14 and then back to 20, I think.
Yeah, because now I was speaking with someone yesterday who they're doing something for one of the streamers, mm-hmm. and that's 8 to 10 episodes. So, you know, it's a little different of a paradigm. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. different commitment. Is it pretty rigorous doing a show that many episodes in a season? You mentioned the COVID thing, but outside of COVID, what's the workflow like for you? Are you working every day?
I mean, I think in the first couple of seasons, it felt a little bit more consistent because our core group of characters was a smaller group. And as the seasons have gone on and we've added more characters that are central to the story and we have more regulars, it really has turned into an ensemble show. And so sometimes, like, let's say the episode is heavily featuring your character, then yeah, you might be in for every day that week. Are you going to be in top to bottom? It's not likely, but you might be in every day. And then if you're light on the episode, you might work anywhere from 3 days on that episode, 5 days on that episode. So it's been really neat to see the evolution of the show, not only in what ends up being the end product, but also with what it seems to me to be like this evolution of a work-life balance that is such an incredible luxury, you know? And I think that comes from top down. Nathan's been doing this for a long time and he wants to have a balanced experience. And so because that's being spoken about and discussed, it kind of trickles down to the rest of us as well, which is like such a gift.
Yeah, I heard him in another interview. And once again, I gotta do some. I would love to talk with him. But where a lot of sets, I think I'm paraphrasing a little bit. I think any actor who's done this for a while has been on some gnarly, uncomfortable, situations. But I think he wanted kind of the antithesis of that. I think he wanted this to be kind of more, you know, professional, chill. People with bad vibes don't, you know, it's not part of the ecosystem that he wants. And, you know, and I it seems like being able to go to work, and it's cool situation and a great show. And then being able to drive right back home, you know, this is not like where you're staying at a hotel in some, you know, remote location shooting, you know, a film. What's that like to be able to just go right back home? Is it something you prefer, or do you kind of want to get out and, you know, do films and be on location and stuff like that?
You know, I think my attitude towards it is similar to the feeling I have in an audition space, which is like there is a... this is an interesting topic for me. On one hand, I have a very deep trust that what is for me, and that if this is the experience I'm having, then there's lots to glean from it. And I try not to spend too much time going, oh, but it's not this and it's not that. And at the same time, I am coming around to understanding that there's a lot of value in aspiring for something. And when my thoughts drift into that space, I notice that my aspirations don't exist so much in my professional life as they do in my life off camera, the experiential aspect of me. Professionally, I don't have aspirations so much of like, oh, I'd love to do like a film that's in Hawaii or something like that. Like, that sounds great, but I'm not like pining for it. My professional pinings kind of lean towards content creation, which I have a hard time pulling the trigger on. I'm sure that would be great though. I love going home. I'm a homebody. I'm a Cancerian. I like to be at home.
Well, I'm learning. I'm an Aquarian. I don't know what that means, but I know it's, did you say ooh?
I said, ooh.
I thought it was like, oh, you're one of the who's. No. So as far as when you say content creation, are you meaning just acting, or are you meaning like, do you do other things creatively? What do you do when you're not professionally creating? What do you like to do creation wise? Well, besides making spring rolls, of course.
Yeah. Well, most of the time I'm reading, and I'm reading about all of the stuff that we've already discussed. I have a hard time with fiction, and yet I have a lot of inspiration from my family. You know, not everybody's family life is going to be a good material for stories, but there's something in my mother's story in particular that I think would make a phenomenal short film. And it's been something that I've been percolating with, and I have like outlines and I start writing, and then I have imposter syndrome when it comes to that space. And I understand, or rather I see and am rather intimidated by what appears to me to be like a mountain of a task to not only complete the writing of something, but then to step into the shoes of a producer and really like sell your idea to people to make it happen. I think it looks like an incredible gauntlet, the people that do take it to completion. And so it's something that I quietly am like, gosh, I would love that. I would really like to set out the steps, the small attainable goals to complete something like that. And I hope that as I mature, that I will kind of shed these fears so that I can just get into executing and not thinking about it.
I mean, it could just be a hobby right now. You could get Final Draft, put it on your computer, or and just play with it and create. And I think that, I was reading the books up here, Save the Cat, about screenplay writing, not too late. Because I do that just kind of for fun, and I think it's just, I don't know if I'll ever sell a screenplay, but there's something cathartic about sitting down, and you got a story, and how does it play out? You know, and I think just about everybody has imposter syndrome. I think a vast majority of the people you live around in LA probably have imposter syndrome, but, you know, even people that are successful, I think that's kind of a component part of things. I think if you don't have a little bit of, like, nerves that, you know, something's a little off, you know, but, you know, you said your mother's story, she being from Hong Kong, but she left and she didn't really have a chance to kind of, am I right in saying she never had a chance to really make that connection to that being her lineage or place or, you know, having traditions and stuff like that. She really didn't absorb a lot of that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, without getting all the way into it, my mom ran away from home. And where she landed was not with her family. And then she ended up, you know, getting pregnant by some white guy and had me. So it's like, it feels like there's a lot of topical things, especially with regards to what's happening in the world these days. And the autonomy of a young woman who is trying to do something brave, albeit rebellious. I think it's a really cool coming of age story, and it also happens to involve all of the things that I think are, that make a good story, like youth, sex, drugs, love. It's got all of it.
I think that'd be wonderful to tell that story though. You should put it together.
Yeah.
And that's so cool that it could be something from your family that you get to bring. It's not just something out of your imagination. Well, it is out of your imagination, but it's something born of, you know, it's your mother's deal, you know, and you get to tell the story. And I think it's pretty fantastic. But that was great. One of the things I want to do, and I always enjoy doing, is I always have my 7 questions I like to ask as a kind of wrap up. It's just a little fun, additional get to know you. And the first question I always ask, because I'm always about the food, is what is your favorite comfort food? That thing that it's like, and I'm sure you're deeply acquainted with it. I mean, COVID, being at home, that thing, it kind of chills you out, brings you back home, makes you feel good.
Pho.
What is that? I'm sorry?
Pho? Vietnamese?
Oh, okay, yeah.
Vietnamese noodle soup?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What do you like in your pho, though? Are you a meatball person? You like the brisket?
No. You know, when I was a little kid, I definitely used to eat those, like, weird beef meatballs, but they're not actually beef. Mm-hmm. They're just, like, this, like, mashup of parts, probably.
Bordeaux knows what it is, yeah.
Yeah, but I love a good bone broth. You know, I really love a delicious... Actually, my favorite thing at a pho restaurant are the vermicelli bowls. Like, I like a cold noodle salad with, like, some spring rolls and then maybe, like, a little bit of chicken. I'm trying not to eat that much meat these days, but that, like, takes me home. Like, I'm instantly in Calgary in the Northeast going somewhere. Somebody brings my dad a fork and he's like, I can use chopsticks. Like, it's like I'm instantly back there. So, yeah.
Now, on a scale of 1 to 10, where are you at on the spiciness, though?
That depends on my mood. I can go there. Okay. I've ruined other people's pho before because I'm like, oh, you got to try this. And they're like, try it. And they're like, I can't eat this. And I've learned to not season other people's food anymore.
Yeah, I can do that with my kids. You know, their big thing is sambal oleg. You know, it's kind of like just it shows up in lots of stuff. So we can handle the spice. But I like the broth to be nice and spicy. You know, that's my thing.
Yum.
But you can tell I haven't had lunch yet today, so I'm talking about food.
I know, so. I'm sorry, that's my fault.
No, that's my fault. I'm working like a fiend, you know. Now, if you were to sit down, like you had 3 people, you're going to be sitting down at a coffee shop, and it could be anybody, but you want to have 4 people, you and 3 people together, a few hours talking story. Who would those 3 people be, you know, living or not?
Ron Murphy. He's a director in Canada. He's an exceptional human being as well as a fantastic storyteller. he's incredible. So that will only land with some people, but it should land with everybody because Ron Murphy is an incredible human being. And then another guy, I'm just going to go, it's another person nobody's going to know. His name is Vlad. He lives in Peru and owns this retreat center. And this dude is Czech, but has lived in Peru for the last 20 years. And he is a deeply steeped person in psychedelic medicines. And he is just a fascinating human being with lots of, I don't want to say war stories, but he is a journeyer and he's got some really amazing tales to tell.
Oh, I've always wanted to meet somebody like that. I was a big, like, Anthony Bourdain was kind of my spirit animal. I always loved watching it. And I was like, that's the job I want, to go out into the world and meet these random people, you know? Now, the next question I got is, when you were young, who was your very first celebrity crush?
Celebrity crush? Gosh, I don't know if I ever had one. If I had one, it was like a cartoon, maybe. I'm trying to think of like the first... Like if I ever had that feeling about like,
or maybe the first person or actor or whatever that you just like, you want to start following them, that they, that something resonated with you when you were young.
I've never,
Okay.
I was at a concert. I'd never felt this before. And at this point, you know, cause we did Canadian Idol, we like met some personalities, you know? And I remember each time people would like freak out and I didn't really have a thing. And then one time I went to a concert and it was a Janet Jackson concert and I was like, this is fine. This is cool. And then she walked out on stage and I had that thing that you see some people have where they're like, they're having a hard time breathing and their chest feels funny. I had that with Janet Jackson. Like when I saw her come out, I was my body started doing something that I didn't understand, like physiologically. Like I just, it was hard to breathe. I was so far away from her, but it was like actually Janet in the flesh. It was so strange. And part of what made it worse was that I was noticing it and I was, all I could think was like, what is happening to my body right now? But yeah, I don't know if I've ever had a crush though. A big part of me having that sensation is like, I kind of like, I get crushes and I fall in love with like personalities, you know? Like the actual person. So yeah.
Very cool. I like that. Yeah. I remember seeing Janet Jackson's, back in my radio days. Anyway, she was
amazing.
She did a great, I remember Black Cat was a song she was playing anyway, but she is a show person. Most certainly. Now let's say you're going to be living on an exotic island. Next question. Is wrapping up. It's an island you want to be on for a year. It's beautiful. It's awesome, but no streaming, no internet, no nothing. So you got to bring.
I was like, there's no water.
No. Okay. It's time for you LA people to rough it. No, I'm just kidding. You have everything. It's a resort. It could be just, you know, something amazing, but there is no way to listen to music or watch movies or anything. So you got to bring one CD with you, one album and one DVD, a movie. What would that CD and movie be to kind of tap into for your entire year?
Oh boy. Okay, let's see. A CD. I think a CD.
It'd be so awesome if you said one of mine. No.
No. Oh god. No.
That'd be awesome.
Oh man, like my brain, I want to say something like super cool and moody and current, but I think you need like all of the colors sometimes. And so I would probably choose like The Game, maybe like Queen, The Game. I love that album.
Oh yeah.
It's got like it has everything in it. You know what I mean? Or The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Like my favorite song on The Game, besides them having all of the crazy hits, is Sail Away, Sweet Sister. Oh my God, that song. Like it's got the ballads, it's got the stuff when you need to chop wood and you're like, yeah, you know, like it has all of the things that you might want to experience and feel supported in. But I would also
say, what part of LA are you living in where you chopping wood? I'm just kind of curious.
I'm on an island now. This is your hypothetical.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I thought that you had some wood chopping. Okay, you're chopping up a palm tree. And
yeah, because I need fire. And And so a DVD. So if I'm practical,
that,
I would
that's
say,
funny you say that. I forgot that that album was so eclectic. Good. It was that's awesome. I like that.
Yeah, it's a good album.
But go on. I'm sorry.
It's okay. And if I'm going to do a DVD, I'd say like maybe depending on the island I'm stranded on, I would get like one of the seasons of Alone so I could like learn from them. Do you watch that show?
Alone? No. What's...
Oh my God, Mark.
I feel like I have
doing?
A homework assignment now.
Yeah, no, you really do. Watch season 8 first. So Alone, it's kind of like Naked and Afraid, but way better because people aren't naked. And also... everything they film, they have to film it themselves. They're survivalists. They get dropped off in these different places. They got Patagonia one year, BC, Alaska twice. And like whoever makes it in the most recent seasons, whoever makes it like 100 days, you have to build your own shelter. You have to catch your own food, everything. You have to do everything by yourself. So I would have a DVD of that so that I could make sure that I don't die and just like learn from them. Sunseed, which is a really lovely DVD compilation of a lot of spiritual teachers, so that I could continue learning and unfolding.
I'm so fascinated. It's like you're such a pleasure to, you know, of all the people I've spoken with. I've spoken with wonderful people, very fascinating. But
do I win the competition?
You went. Actually, I was thinking of something. I got this little thing in South Padre Island. We go down there every year, South Texas coast, you know, my kids and I. And I found this little thing. It's almost like I went into this place, and I'll show you in a second. Okay. And I was looking for something. I got tchotchkes and stuff all over my desk and all over my speakers. And I found this neat little thing. It's each little stone. I'll go and show you. I don't know if my camera will zoom. Each one of those is a different kind of stone.
Vibratory.
And at the very top is some kind of energy coil. How much do I believe? I just thought it looked really cool. I sit there, and everything you're saying is like, that's the kind of stuff I imagine finding around your house. It's kind of like you're.
Yeah, I know. You can kind of see some of my stations set up. I do have some. I have some tchotchkes. I have some sacred things.
Yeah, that's very cool. I like somebody to introspect. I like being reminded that you need to do that because sometimes we get so knee deep in our lives, we kind of forget. You got to take a moment.
We all need reminders.
Absolutely. Now, if not last couple of questions, if you weren't doing this for a living, if acting, singing, creative was not performing was not part of your ecosystem, what would that you were doing? What would you be doing for a job? What would your career be?
You know, I feel really drawn to being a student, and I know that I wouldn't be able to do that like endlessly. If that could be a career, I would make a career out of like endlessly being a student, and maybe I would be maybe like a recluse. But I have been told from a psychic that I did not ask for this. She looked at me very pointedly and she was like, do not go to a monastery. You're not supposed to do that. And I was like, how did you know? Like, I felt like a rat. Like, I was just like caught in the light. And I would want to be a student like endlessly and to probably just like be in service. I mean, that's the ideal. And I guess if I have to make money, I wouldn't mind going back to school so that I could explore Chinese medicine. I find it really fascinating. And it's a really interesting like synthesis of, you know, spirit, physical things, and also cosmological information. Like it's this totally harmonized system to bring people into wellness on all levels. And so
even food, view food as medicine as well, you know, and that's fascinating. So you'd be in school, but I think also teaching, it sounds like would be something, you know, being a teacher and being able to pass along the stuff you learned sounds like something you'd be doing.
If I was, I would be likely doing it reluctantly.
Really?
I think so.
Well, you got to share your wisdom. It's important stuff, you know, give it to the rest of us so we can pass, you know, the pay it forward thing, you know.
Right.
Now, the last question, if you're to jump in your DeLorean, you can go back to when you're 16 years old.
Okay.
And, you know, you can cruise back. And you got a piece of advice for, you got a few minutes with 16-year-old you. And you want to get 16-year-old you, let's say, on a better track or maybe help. Just in general terms, what would that piece of advice be that would be of real value for 16-year-old Melissa?
You are not your body. Stop stressing out. Just feed it well. Make sure you move it. But don't obsess over it. It's going to be okay.
That's a very common thing that
Yeah.
I hear, but it's not, it's said in different ways, but it's the same thing. It's going to be okay. Or another thing I hear a lot is, and this alludes to something you said earlier, but the idea of don't wait, do it, when you were talking about writing and stuff like that. And I was like, just do that thing. I can't tell you how much of a real pleasure it is to, sit down with you today. And I didn't ask a single thing about what's going to be going on with you and Tim this season. I didn't because I didn't.
I was like, this guy doesn't even watch the show. He's never even asked about Eric or Tim. Like, I
Oh,
don't even know what's
oh
going
God, no.
on.
Trust me, the way the season ended last year, my kids and I, it's the show we always watch. And as you see our DVR, because my daughter is off at, was off at college, it's like letting all the rookies just stack up, I do have to say, just one last note. I love the way the relationship, be it the writing and the relationship the two of you had with Eric Winter, the way it's evolved from him calling you boot and all that stuff, the kind of the way they did, to now, you're passing a little wisdom on to him in some way. It was just an evolution. And like I say, I want to get be surprised like everybody else. I don't like spoilers, but seeing where things are, going, it's I think Rosalind Sanchez might be having some issues with you soon. It's just an assumption.
No way. She loves me. I love her. If
I'm
anything,
just
I'm always like, when we're at work, I'm constantly trying to like help Eric spend his money on Rosalind because I'm not immune to it. I'm trying to stay off my phone more, but like. You know how Instagram is these days. They're just constantly selling you stuff. And for some reason, like I'll see the stuff they're trying to sell me. And I don't really know a lot of people with those body types, but Rosalind has like, she looks like a model. Like, I mean, she is a model. And I'm like, Eric, you should get this for Rosalind. She would look good in it. I'm constantly trying to get him to buy like outfits and jewelry for her. Cause I'm like, she would look amazing. So, no.
Well, I think that show's got to be so much fun to shoot. It's just the fact that you're living in a city where you're also shooting it. It's one of the few shows where LA is part one of the characters in the show, and it's like, it's just, I imagine the downtime. You have a pretty nice constellation of characters and personalities, and we'll send you some New Orleans food or something. If you can tell, do a little bump over to your. To your boss and say, "Hey, I talked to this guy. I really wants to talk to you,"
No,
because no, because y'all both have that sci-fi background, which is kind of
Yes,
cool.
we do.
But no, I really appreciate you taking time out. I think my kids will finally think I'm cool after speaking with you. Maybe I'll get closer to cool, but it's certainly looking forward to this season and love the character arc. And I think though I don't like necessarily cliffhangers and make you wait for months to figure out what happened. I was like, okay, this has been, I want to see where this goes. There you go. You're creative. You need to get out there and write that screenplay.
How dare you?
If I ever bump into you in the streets of LA when I'm out there in a couple months, I'll be like, how's that screenplay coming? I'll be that one annoying person that that karmically that just keeps showing up and bugging you. Next thing you know, that'll be a big
Well,
hit.
hey,
Or
do let me know if you're ever in LA. I'd love to serve you tea sometime.
what's your favorite tea though?
I like Chopoers.
Now I have to go do research on that. I was thinking like matcha, I'm
I
going
mean,
basic,
it's definitely no. We are talking about tea ceremony though, so you're not all the way off
Oh,
yet.
I've always wanted to take part in something like that. I just think there's something very civilized about me. I'm just drinking my, gallon of coffee here.
It's all good. Yeah.
Again, I appreciate your time. I look forward to the upcoming season, and hopefully down the line we'll have a chance to connect. Maybe one day we'll do the tea. How about that?
Yes. Let me know if you're in LA. That's not an empty invitation.
Melissa, health, happiness, prosperity to you, and I look forward to catching up with you down the line.
And you as well. Thank you so much, Mark.
All right, there you go, Melissa O'Neill. So enjoyed this chat. Really had a great time getting to know Melissa. She has such a great story, and I love her energy, her vibe. I really am glad I had the chance to share this conversation with you. And I appreciate you coming back by every week. Great conversations on the way. And of course, as always, pop on by storyandcraftpod.com. You can find out anything you could possibly want to know about the show, listen to past episodes. And don't forget, you can also listen to the show on your favorite podcast app. So listen, subscribe, like. That way you get notifications every time a new episode comes out. And don't forget, if you can, if you would, drop a little review in there. Appreciate it if you would. All right, so please go have a safe and awesome rest of your week. And I'll see you next time right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.